and said, I tried to listen to the study to find out where we had ended, and, oh, I can't stand to listen to my own voice. I don't know how you guys do it. It's horrible. It's terrible just to hear yourself, like, I hear myself different in my own.
This is the way the Lord made you.
I sound like a Baltimore hillbilly.
You want me to add to that? I had Judy walk away quietly yesterday.
Holy cow. There was a miracle. There was a miracle yesterday.
Granddaughter asked me your nickname?
I don't know.
Yeah, who was me? I couldn't remember. I know she thought I just wouldn't tell her, but I was just trying to make out.
Ketchup and mustard.
I turned it on. So we're getting all this for blackmail purposes. So last week, it's kind of interesting. I was going to start out, again, just kind of refresh our minds about Jonathan and just what an awesome life story that we're given on his behalf in the scripture, and what a beautiful relationship he had with David. And there's some really important things here, like verse 15 when it says, don't cut off from your kindness. He knows he's going to be king. And he said, don't cut off from your kindness my family. And David takes a vow, and you'll see, I mean, obviously as this goes further and further into the future, you'll see David, you know, attempt to uphold that part of the bargain and that part of his covenant that he made. And so many people in the scripture we see, you know, make vows and make all kinds of stuff, and they just completely ignore them. And David didn't have that kind of backbone. He really tried to do. Failed at many things, but when it came to this thing, he was very, very, and we talked about how to love someone as you love yourself just has to be the most incredible, because as much as we don't think about it, we just love ourselves. You can do things. I mean, yeah, some of us, it's probably the only love we get. Deservedly so. But every time, you know, you stick your head in the refrigerator or, you know, whatever you do when you go to the store and you're looking at all the stuff and you buy, oh, I love this snack or I love this food, all that is self-love. You're like, hey, this is what I want. So to say that you love another being as much as you love yourself is a true, true testament. And it's actually supernatural. There's no way that you can love somebody as yourself without not being inspired from God.
See, I got to interject in how you're saying you go to the supermarket and you get stuff and self-love. Well, my wife always just thought I was mean, getting exactly what she put on the list. When she sent me to the grocery, it was showing my love to her. If I get exactly what she wanted,
oh, give me up. Right. Oh,
the law kills. The law kills. You should shop with grace. Shop with grace. All right, so we'll go on this morning. And then Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon feast, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. So obviously, David, when there's a feast, the king, since David's a member of the king's court, he's going to go sit with the king and have enjoy this feast. The problem is the king's trying to kill him. So Jonathan, so they're kind of coming up with a plan, and he says, you know, the king's going to notice that your seat is empty. And so he said, the day after tomorrow, toward evening, go to the place where you hid when this trouble began and wait by the stone at Azel. I got a little further in here. I got a map. We can kind of go back and look at some of these places. I will shoot three arrows to the side of it as though I were shooting at a target. Then I will send a boy and say, go find the arrows. If I say to him, look, the arrows are on this side of you, bring them here, then come, because as surely as the Lord lives, you are safe and there is no danger. But if I say to the boy, look, the arrows are beyond you, then you must but go, because the Lord has sent you away. And about the matter you and I discussed, remember the Lord is witness between you and me forever. So he's going back to what we talked about, that account, like be you know, mindful of my family forever, no matter what happens, what comes out of this. And it's pretty interesting. They came up with a clever little code, if you will, for staying safe. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon feast came, the king sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul, but David's place was empty. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he is unclean. So the first day he just, you know, kind of rationed out in his mind that, hey, there's a reason for him not being here. He didn't raise the alarm on the first day. But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered, David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me go away to see my brothers. That is why he has not come to the king's table. So Jonathan's obviously put his neck out a little bit for David. And Saul's anger flared. Flared up at Jonathan, he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother who bore you? So this gets kind of shows you the heart of Saul at this point. He is just trying to cling on to the throne and establish a dynasty at all costs. And now he has, I'm sure he's seen how close, I mean, two friends that are that caring about each other, it's going to be kind of hard to hide that. And so the king knows. So, but, you know, to say this about his son, who's been nothing but kind of kind, and his, you know, he's never rebuked his father, like, directly. He's always, like, asked rational questions and kind of let the king realize what he's doing, and here he's just blown his lid. As long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you or your kingdom will be established. Now, son, send someone to bring him to me, for he must die. So this is pretty clear, and again, you see what Saul's heart is here. He's going to establish a monarchy that, you know, will hold on. He's been told the kingdom's been ripped from your hands, you know. He's been told that. And he could have accepted that kind of gracefully the way Jonathan did and just said, you know, conjecture, again, nothing. Who knows if he had, you know, been like, okay, yeah, you're right, I made a mistake. I'll mentor David and he'll take over the kingdom. And he could have been some part of that, just not king. But he's accepting the top spot or no spot.
How many parents in here actually ask their son to submit to the Lord and just trust and yield their authority that they've wanted to hand over them their whole life?
Right.
And to give it to someone else just to trust the Lord.
It's, you know,
it's not typical of any of them.
It's rare.
Most
agreed.
Of us want our children to succeed, and we set stuff up for them. I think it's a good lesson.
Right. That, you know, it's not your, I, like I said, a wise man. I you know, every parent goes through those struggles with your kid. I don't know if any of us have a family of perfect kids. But, you know, I was really agonizing over some decisions that, you know, my kids were making. And and somebody gave me a really, really, just one of those things you'll just carry through life, though. He said, when they turn out good, you can't accept the adulation for that. And when they make mistakes, you don't carry the blame for all that. You did the best. If you did the best you could and tried to raise them, they're a human being. They're going to make all their own choices. So that was just, that just eased my heart so much, because I was always like, what did I do wrong that, you know, brought this, that allowed somebody to make these decisions? But at some point, they're an adult, and they're going to make their own decisions. And, you know, Adam walked in the garden with God and still made bad choices, right? So it's inherent. So it's pretty – so at this point, I guess we have been talking about how this isn't necessarily in chronological order, and how Jonathan throughout this, I guess as a son and looking at your dad, and, you know, there had to be some adulation there growing up, and he just keeps thinking, nah, my dad's not trying to kill you. My dad's not – you know, you're seeing this even in this maze up. He's like, I'm going to go see my dad. There's a chance that you're reading this all wrong. And, you know, I can bring you back to the feast and it's all going to be good. And right here he says, for he must die. So that puts it pretty clear. And then, so Jonathan talks, answers himself, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asks his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Here he makes an attempt. He's supposedly trying to give the kingdom to his son. And he's so out of control of his emotions and his rage that he almost kills the thing he's trying to lift up in defiance of the Lord. It's just, he's just become a madman at this point, really. I mean,
where did he look at his son, Jonathan, as now deserving?
Right, as
he
a traitor.
Other brothers.
Yeah.
He had other brothers. So.
But obviously, whatever reason, you know, with the wives and the concubine things, we've been through that a million times. You never know what the deal was with that. But for some reason, he seemed to favor Jonathan. So Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger, and on the second day of the feast, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. So that's, you know, there you see the two contrasting. Saul's completely out of control, and Jonathan's just like so emotionally wrecked that he won't even eat with his dad or eat with anybody. In the morning, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, run and find the arrows I shoot. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. After him, he said, isn't the arrow beyond you? So that's kind of, if you'll remember, the signal. And the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrows fall, and Jonathan called out. Then he shouted, hurry, go quickly, don't stop. And the boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. So obviously this is that signal. He said, if I say if he goes to the left or the right, then you know it's good. And if I shoot it beyond him, you know that the signal is it's not good. Don't come back. And it's kind of interesting here that I don't know who the boy is and who it's mentioned in Scripture, but they kind of give him cover in this, and that they say the boy knew nothing, or that the boy couldn't betray the signal, that they knew where they were the only two people they could trust. And we're going to, I don't know how far we'll get, but you'll see basically the antithesis of Jonathan in another character in the Scripture. You're going to see a very, very unscrupulous guy.
But if you look at that, how he made that plan, he must have had some kind of idea that it wasn't going to go. Because you always plan for the best, and you don't plan as much for the worst. If they planned for the worst, he planned a lot for the worst. Even though he was hoping for the best.
Yeah, you never know. He had to have some hints that his dad was, you know, a little off his rockers, off his meds. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, go carry them back to town. And after the boy had gone, David got up on the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times. and with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. So here you see him, he just gives his weapons to the boy to make sure he's got a reason to return to the king. Basically, I'm carrying the stuff and I'm younger and I can run, and so Jonathan will be behind me. It won't look suspicious that Jonathan didn't come back right with me. And you can see that the love, you know, these two have for each other is just, you know, really awesome. And then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left, and Jonathan went back to town. So again, they keep reminding each other of this covenant they made, you know, about, you know, Jonathan, you feel like he has a heart with God, that he knows who's going to be king. And he was willing to accept a role, you see that a couple times, that he was willing to accept a role in David's kingship, you know, under David's kingship. Wasn't a big deal to him. But his dad is just not going to let that happen mercifully. So here, if you could kind of see up at the top, you see Gibeah of Saul. You see that right above the Na. It's kind of right in the middle, a little high. Then Ramah, that's where Saul was. Ramah is where Samuel went when that was. And then we're going to see this place, Nob, if you'll remember, is where the Ark of the Covenant went. When after it returned from the Philistines, remember, Jerusalem isn't really a big deal at this time. You know, David's the one that makes Jerusalem the capital of the kingdom. At this point, Saul kind of does this thing in Gibeah. That's kind of for me too, because I kind of always think, oh, Jerusalem, the capital, and you hear him talk about these other places, and you're like, why is this? And then you got to think, oh, none of that has been established at this point. But now it becomes kind of important because that's where the ark is and where the priests are. So I found this. So I'll kind of keep popping this up because we can see this will have a whole, as we go through the next couple of chapters, this will be all the places that David flees to and different things happen in different places. So chapter 21. David went to Nob, to Elimelech the priest. And Elimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" So, you know, I was kind of sick dwelling on this for a little bit. So you don't know if the whole kingdom knew that, you know, Saul and David had issues, or was it just that David, you know, everybody's used to the king's, people in the king's court traveling with you know, a group of people, and all of a sudden this guy shows up and he's kind of out of breath and got not much with him, and you're like, what's the problem? And this is going to be an interesting, very, very interesting chapter in what goes on. And David answered Elimelech the priest, "The king sent me on a mission and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about my mission I am sending you on. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place.' Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find." So this is going to be a really, really interesting situation, because Jesus even expounds on this in the New Testament when he talks about, so we're going to see what the bread is. But at this point, David's lying, right? So this is, it's an odd thing. You feel like you can, in your mind, and you can rationalize and you can kind of justify it. But the bottom line is he's lying. So, you know, that has an interesting, but like I said, that Jesus expounds on it in the New Testament. So it's a really interesting mashup. Again, sometimes what people mean for evil, you know, God can use for good, and he'll use every situation, no matter what the mistakes people make.
And of course, Jonathan lied in the previous chapter.
Yep. To his dad. But the priest answered David and said, I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women. So what this is you know what the showbread is. So in the tabernacle, there are loaves of bread that are the showbread that sit in the tabernacle, but every Sabbath, every Sabbath, they are changed out, and fresh bread is put in their place, and this bread is given to the priests as part of their, you know, they're getting meat from the sacrifice and this stuff, and this bread is part of that, part of their wages, more or less. So the priest is saying, hey, you know, you can have this, I could spare this, but the men have to have been consecrated, which it's kind of just kind of reading over this, say, okay, David and his men. Up to this point, David's men haven't really been mentioned. You kind of picture David fleeing on his own. So now all of a sudden he's talking about David's men, so you don't know, you know, what number he has. You see at different times he has 300 guys. He kind of lives this Robin Hood life, you know, out in the Sherwood Forest, where he's got like these followers, not men in tights, but they're followers. But at this point, you don't really have a number, but he's saying, hey, there's other ones with me, there's other people with me, and we haven't been with any women. That would make them unclean to be, they couldn't take the ceremonial bread from the tabernacle if they had, you know, been with their wives or whatever. So that's what's at play here. So David replied, indeed, women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The men's bodies are holy, even on missions that they are holy. How much more so today? He's basically saying, look, whenever we go out on a mission, we make sure that we're in good graces with God, basically, that, you know, we're ceremonial clean and, you know, we've done all the right things. Again, you don't really know how many people are with him. Is he by himself? Is he going to take all five loaves? Or is five loaves enough to feed, you know, how many ever? But it's got to be better than nothing. So the priest gave him the consecrated bread. Since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. And there's that every Sabbath. Sabbath, the bread switched out, new bread's placed in, and the old bread is taken out. Now one of Saul's servants was there that day and detained before the Lord. So that's a weird, I was looking at that. You can go off on all kind of tangents on detained before the Lord. So you don't know if this was part of God's plan at this point, that he had gotten delayed by God. There's everything is circumspect. I can't make a, you'll just have to understand what detained before the Lord. You'll have to like look at that in your own. But it gives you the feeling that God had him there on purpose. But this guy Doeg is, when I talked about the antithesis of Jonathan, this is that guy. So Doeg the Edomite, Saul's chief shepherd. So there's some things at play there. First off, he's an Edomite. He is an enemy of God's people. Throughout, when they came out of Egypt, the Edomites warred against them. You know, the brothers against each other. It's been time immemorial, still playing out today somewhat. So here he's a member of Saul's, like he's the chief of his staff. So there's a thing here that he might have been, and I devoted a whole slide to him, but there's a thing that here that as he might have been, the way this says chief shepherd, he might have been in the royal court in Edom and became a traitor to Edom and ingratiated himself with Saul. And Saul, at this point, has no discernment. So that's kind of how this will play out, and we'll see some. So David asked Elimelech, don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's mission was urgent. The priest replied, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah is here, and it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want to take it, take it. There is no sword here but that one. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. So if we go back, then the sword is like, it's like the picture of this little, you know, a toddler with dad's, you know, sword trying to drag it across the ground. This thing is huge. So it had to kind of look out of place, but this just shows a little more desperation on David's part. He's like, willing, I'll take anything at this point, you know. So I kind of went and did a little research on this guy, and it's kind of strange. Again, you'll see here some of this is speculation, and I'll kind of point that out, that it's not, you know, scripturally perfect, but some of it is. Some of it you do get to see. So it says, and this is, I looked this up in a Bible dictionary. It says, Doeg was an evil man. Although he pretended to serve Israel, he only served himself. One day while David was running from Saul, he stopped to seek assistance at a tabernacle in Nob. And it so happened that Doeg was also in the tabernacle that day, detained before the Lord. It could be that Doeg was at the tabernacle because of the Sabbath day, and he could travel no further without breaking the law. Or he could be there and he was offered a sacrifice to complete a vow or to be ceremonially cleansed. Regardless of why Doeg was there, this is a faithful encounter with David. So this is some of the other stuff that I've researched. It says, Doeg was probably a leader in Edom that had become a traitor. He had no loyalty to anyone except the king, who could use him, and that would advance his own cause. Hence, he had no compulsion. I'm kind of getting a little ahead of myself here, but I had to take the definition of what killing a priest of Yahweh would mean. He did the deed with ruthless ambition. David wrote about him in Psalm 52. And here, as you guys know, all the Psalms have kind of a heading in them. And the heading of the Psalm is about Doeg the Edomite, which can be translated Doeg the Red, which some have taken the script of a nickname for the brutal man, meaning Doeg the Bloody. So, you know, you can kind of read into that as far as you want to go. But it's really interesting that David wrote about him in Psalm 52. And it says, why boasteth thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. The tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. Selah, which means dwell on that. Think about that. Thou lovest devouring words, O thy deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living. Selah. Think about that. The righteous shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in the wickedness. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever, and I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it, and I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints. So then a little more. So there's a, I didn't write it down here, I don't think. So there's like a, some descriptive books that some priests have written. They're not biblical, they're not scriptural, but they kind of ascribe many things to this guy. So I'll just kind of, just for your own, take it or leave it, it doesn't matter. It says, not, and I'm not sure of the truth, but the Jewish stories say that it was Doeg that convinced Saul not to kill Agag. So that lost him the kingdom, first off. Let alone that's going to come back to really, really play a role in the history of Israel way on down the line. He sounded the praise of David before Saul in order to provoke his jealousy and ascribing to David qualities that Saul lacked. He cherished a grudge against David, whose opinion prevailed over his own, determining the site of the temple at Jerusalem. And he had well nigh succeeded in providing by his argument that David, as a descendant of Ruth the Moabite, could not, according to the law, before the congregation of Israel, when the prophet Samuel interposed on David's favor. He also declared David's marriage with Michal to be invalid and induced Saul to marry her to another. So, you know, he's basically the Grinch at this point. And I don't know how much of that's true. That's just kind of there. And, you know, it could be Bigfoot for all I know, you know. But it could be. Sometimes there's some things, even though they're carried and kept blown up in history, there's a little bit of truth buried in that. So, obviously, when I talked about he is the opposite of Jonathan, who loved David more than himself, here this guy couldn't love himself anymore and has no, and we're going to see, he has no loyalty to anybody but the king. He's not loyal to the people of Israel or anything like that. He's out. He's all for the king because the king can be all for him. That's the bottom line in his life. I'll come back to that one. So that day David fled from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Anybody see a problem with that? Anybody know somebody famous from Gath?
Why?
Yeah. So, yeah, and he has his sword dragging behind him in the dirt, and he goes to the king. And you don't know, you know, I was kind of reading some commentaries, and they said, you know, you don't know if he fled there thinking, I can keep a low profile, nobody will recognize me, and you know, this is the last place Saul looked for me among, you know, the enemies of the people. So if I kind of slide in here, I can keep a low profile and stay safe. And either, you know, either that or he just, at this point, well, I guess the point I was going to make, at this point it seems David is just winging it. You never at this point said David went to seek, you know, counsel with God. He's just winging it. He's told lies. You know, you're gonna see a really, really interesting lie prevailed here, but you never see David's, you know, it saying David reached out to God and said, what should I do? And I kind of was looking back at it. You've just been so through our lives, we've just been through so many teachings on David and Saul, and you're just not, you know, here was this young boy when he was out in, you know, guarding the sheep and the shepherd. And it was just him and God. There was no pretentious, you know, he was dealing with wild animals. You knew they were wild. You dealt with them accordingly. So he has spent his life just in, and you kind of see that when he first goes and is talking about Goliath. He's like, you guys are letting this guy say this about God. I don't think he said it to be pretentious. He just had communed with God so much, he wasn't used to how dealing with people between him and God. And so you just look at this, you don't know if this has spun him, just thinking about, he's not used to the treachery of human beings when it comes to God. I think he had this thought that everybody loves God like I do, and nobody's going to cheat me, and nobody's going to be nasty, and nobody's going to be, and he's finding out that that is not the reality. And people are devious, and people are horrible, and maybe that shook him. And again, this is all Chris's conjecture. Maybe that kind of shook him to his foundation. So at this point, he really just kind of winging it, and he's just off and running. And he's not seeking God. He's just in a complete panic mode, and it causes all kinds of problems for him, which it causes in our own lives when, you know, people mistreat us, we've all been through, I've had people that I really, really looked up to and thought they were amazing betray me, you know, or do things, and it really does rock you to your core. And, you know, especially if you're thinking this person is a man of God and I really look up to him and I do, it rocks your core beliefs in God. You're like, wait a minute. And that's constantly why God is telling us, men will fail you. It's not about, I can use who I can use. But there's supposed to be nobody between you and me. There, you can have a mentor. You can have people that help you. And as long as they're pointing you to me, they're good. But the minute that doesn't happen, and don't expect it not to happen, really. And we just constantly are just, and again, as human beings, we love nothing more than sticking people up on pedestals, and then after some point, oh, he's on his high horse, we like to kick the pedestal out. You know, so we've set our own people up to destroy them, and then we're blown away that they're destroyed. I mean, I've just seen it so many times that, like, I was a young Christian, and you just look at these guys that are pastors and stuff, and you're like, oh, you know, I just have Christianity 1.0, and these guys, like, are on Christianity 3.1.1, and if they could just pray for me and do something for me, they will elevate my Christianity so much, because I can't do it myself. They got to do it for me. And so many people sit in pews and let, you know, somebody talk, and it's awesome, and then all of a sudden something happens, and you're, like, blown away that this guy that you said, you know, you thought in your mind was Christian 3.11 has now revealed his flesh and has ripped you apart and torn down your little statue to him you built, you know, your own little idol. So, and that's what, you know, we constantly do that. And I just find it interesting that I've just seen us build people up to do nothing but tear them down. You know, and not to, I would never be a pastor, and God bless the pastors and stuff like that. But I've just, you think about it, I've seen the kind of hero worship that's gone on sometimes with pastors, and we blow smoke in their face and their head swells up, and then we can't believe they've got a big head at some point. You know, and we're the ones that, you know, for 5 years everybody told this guy how great he was every Sunday morning and how amazing everything was, and then all of a sudden we can't believe the guy's a big head. But we're the ones that did it. So just have to be really, really careful about that was Chris on his soapbox. But that was just, that's just been my own private experience of what we do as Christians. And anytime you let somebody get between you and your relationship with Jesus Christ, that is doomed for failure. Somebody comes alongside and is walking with you in that relationship and helping you strengthen that relationship, great. But if they're between you and God and they're the ones that your focus is now on, it's going to be a fall. There's going to be a terrible catastrophe, a stumble. And so here, we'll kind of stop here, but the servants of Achish, who's the king, said to him, isn't this David the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sang about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousand, and David his tens of thousands. Anybody notice anything interesting in that verse?
He said the king.
The king. It's really interesting that everybody else seems to know what Saul doesn't. You know, and Saul's trying to fight, so he's kicking at the goats. So, sorry I got off on my little bit of tangent there. I'm not a pastor, I'm not anything, but I've just seen that a couple times in my life. By the power invested in the internet. Well, that's true, but I mean,
no matter what, we all have that.
We have that role in our life, but
everyone.
I am not the pastor in the normal of what the Christian church has produced as a. You know. So
it's a mini poo.
Yes.
This time on Sunday morning, I didn't get it off because I was getting ready. But this guy in, I think they said Boston, they made him bishop of one of the churches. And he was all dressed up in, you know, all this fancy garb. And they said, and he had on a bulletproof vest. That's how bad it is. I guess.
Oh, my. Wow.
Yeah. So you better off not be a pastor.
Yeah. It's the new